You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keely Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, Madison, Milwaukee, and cities across the country are dealing with more shootings and homicides this year. We'll talk about what goes into violence prevention work being done by community groups and what long-term solutions they have in mind. First, you've probably seen news stories about cases of people wrongfully convicted for crimes that other people committed. We've talked here on Central Time with people who've regained their freedom after years in prison for crimes they didn't commit. And we've heard from lawyers who work to get justice for them. Today, we're going to hear about a different kind of wrongful conviction, those in which there was actually no crime. Jessica Henry is the author of the new book, Smoke But No Fire, Convicting the Innocent of Crimes That Never Happened. She was a New York City public defender for nearly 10 years and is now an associate professor in the Department of Justice Studies at Montclair State University. Jessica, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Certainly. We have to start with this idea that some people are convicted of crimes that never actually happened. We can dig into specifics as we go along, but give us an overview of how people can be arrested for, let alone convicted, of something that didn't even happen.
When I first stumbled on this, I was as shocked as perhaps some of your listeners are. And really, there's a number of ways that this occurs. But just to give you the big picture or the scope, over one third of all people who have ever been exonerated that we know of were convicted of crimes that never happened. So this is not a small one-off phenomenon. This is something that happens with shocking frequency. And the way that it happens is varied. So it can either be a mislabeling occurs at the scene of an event. So let's say a fire burns down an apartment building and the fire person who shows up at the scene decides it was an arson when really it was an electrical fire or there was some other natural cause. Sometimes we see that in the case of a child who is found dead and they assume that it was shaken baby syndrome or some other kind of harm was committed to the child when in fact there was an undiagnosed or underlying illness that caused the baby's death. There are also cases of false accusations where people wrongly accuse folks of manufactured crimes for whatever motivation, whether it's for revenge or for financial gain or to cover up their own wrongdoing. We see that in a number of instances. Sometimes it's the police that actually plant evidence on innocent suspects, creating crimes that never occurred in the first place. So there's a whole host of triggers that can start the process of a wrongful conviction based on events that were not criminal in the first place. And then the criminal justice system kicks in and turns these non-criminal events into actual convictions where innocent people's lives are destroyed.
You make the point that this is not new. I mean, you look back to the Salem witch trials as an example.
Yes. You know, Salem witch trials is one of the earliest examples where people were executed for the crimes that they committed, allegedly for being witches and engaging in witchcraft. But probably the first known no crime wrongful conviction occurred in the case of brothers who were charged with the murder of their brother-in-law. And we find out really literally on the eve of their hanging that the brother-in-law was alive and well in New Jersey. And so they were, you know, sort of saved from the gallows at the very last minute. And this is a recurring theme where people are accused of things that just didn't occur. And then the whole sort of system comes in to prove that they were guilty.
It just seems like, I mean, you're talking about the gallows. We're hearkening back to the Salem witch trials. This feels like something that should have happened in the past, not something that should account for a third of wrongful convictions even now.
Yeah, and yet it happens today all too frequently.
Are there certain people who are more at risk for being thought of as committing a crime if the situation is unclear?
Yeah, so it depends on the nature of the crime that someone's been charged with. So one part of the book that I talk about, which is maybe less dramatic, but I think is still quite important to think about, are in the misdemeanor context. And there we see the police sort of going after poor people and people of color and prosecuting them for arresting them for low-level offenses like loitering or trespassing, when in fact these people were doing nothing wrong at all. But upon an arrest and getting booked and, you know, being dragged into court and sometimes having to spend the night in jail, people will often plead guilty to things they did not do in order to get out and go home and get back to their children and their responsibilities, their jobs. So at the very low end, we do see lots of people, particularly poor people and people of color, who get pulled into the system for crimes that simply didn't occur.
Jessica Henry has written a book about people convicted of crimes that never happened. And we're talking about what that means and where we see this happening. We're also taking your questions for her at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about her research into this kind of exoneration of people who were convicted of crimes that didn't actually happen in the first place? Jessica, you can point to Wisconsin. There's a case from 1995 that's an example of one of the categories you talked about, those non-crime convictions, the issue of shaken baby syndrome. Tell us about Audrey Edmonds.
Yeah, so Audrey Edmonds was a stay-at-home mom. She had sort of a home daycare, and she watched children from the neighborhood. And one of her neighbors dropped off her six-month-old daughter sort of with a warning, like, oh, she seems a little fussy today, and went on her way. And shortly after that, Edmonds noticed that the baby was gasping for air, and she called 911, and the baby died later that night. And there was a misdiagnosis. The forensic pathologist determined that the baby had died from shaken baby syndrome. And shaken baby syndrome is sort of something that many people have heard of in the news. The way that it kind of works is if a baby presents with these three specific symptoms, they call it a triad. So if they find a baby that has these triad of symptoms, then it was presumed that the baby died of shaken baby syndrome and that the person who was last in the baby's care must have been the person who had done the violent shaking. So by definition, in Audrey Edmonds' case, she was the person last in the baby's care, in the baby's presence, and therefore she must have been the person who killed this infant. And, you know, at trial, the prosecution presented this evidence about shaken baby syndrome. And in her defense, Audrey Edmonds presented character witnesses who said there's just no way that Audrey Edmonds would ever have committed this kind of crime. And yet she was convicted, and she served 11 years in prison before she was finally exonerated by scientific evidence that established the baby had not died from shaken baby syndrome.
And when this happened, Audrey Edmonds from Wanakee, Wisconsin, was, pregnant with her third child. I mean, a lot happens in 11 years, and that's just all gone because of a crime that didn't ever happen.
Exactly. Her whole life was completely upended. And to your point, 11 years is an eternity for instance, in Audrey Edmonds' case, for a parent who is forcibly separated from their children, particularly for a horrible crime, right, where she becomes labeled a monster and a baby killer and, you know, all kinds of horrible names, when in fact she had done nothing wrong and the child had died from an illness or an injury that occurred accidentally or naturally, and certainly not at Audrey Edmonds' hands.
We are talking with former public defender Jessica Henry about her book, Smoke with No Fire, and it's about convicting the innocent of crimes that never happened. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Is this something you've heard of before, or are you coming across this for the first time? Can you imagine how a person could be suspected of and arrested for and then convicted of a crime that wasn't actually a crime? Has something similar happened to you or somebody you know? Give us a call at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. We continue this conversation in a moment. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. Thanks for joining us here on the Ideas Network. I'm Keeley Boltina. Our guest is Jessica Henry. She's a former public defender who's written a book about the fact that we convict people of crimes that never happened in the first place. I wasn't familiar with the idea until this book. Do you know about this? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. Can you see how assumptions about a person could lead to the belief that they committed a crime that hadn't actually occurred? What do you think needs to be fixed in our criminal justice system and judicial systems to prevent this from happening? 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jessica, for those individuals or groups who are working on raising awareness around the issues, how important is this idea of non-existent crimes?
I think it's incredibly important because there is 100% no societal interest that supports the conviction of people for crimes that simply didn't happen. And the way that it occurs really shines a light on just how broken at every step of the process our criminal legal system is. And if we take it seriously, if we really want to understand how no crime wrongful convictions happen, we may actually be able to not only prevent their frequency, but also improve the criminal justice system as a whole.
Who are the people involved in investigating a possible crime that can send the process in the wrong direction or make it more likely that something would be treated as a crime, even if it isn't?
Well, I start the book out with one of the most heartbreaking stories that, for me, I've come across. There was a man down in Louisiana named Rodriguez Crawford, and he was wrongly convicted and sentenced to death in Louisiana for murdering his young son. And what happened was he woke up in the morning, the child had slept in his bed with him and was not moving. And when he called 911, there was just such a lack of regard for Mr. Crawford. The 911 operator made some very snide comments to the EMT driver, sort of saying, you know, well, they're acting like a fool over there. And they said, probably slept on the damn baby. And they just took their sweet time in even arriving to their home. And then when they got there, they immediately presumed that Mr. Crawford had harmed his own child. Instead of treating him like a grieving and distraught father, they treated him as a criminal suspect. They put the baby in the ambulance and waited for the police to come before they told the family that the baby, in fact, was dead. And then instead of bringing him, Mr. Crawford, to the hospital, or allowing him to stay home and mourn with his family, they brought him to the police station and interrogated him for hours about his child's death. And again, it took a really long time for his innocence to eventually be revealed after many years on death row. But race played a huge factor in the entire process, and the EMTs who arrived presumed that he had engaged in some harming his child. So they looked at the crime scene through a specific lens. They were biased in examining the baby, and you see that bias kind of creeping in through every single stage of the process, including the prosecutor, including the defense lawyers, including even, you know, the jury. It was one of those stories that when you look back on it, you think, my goodness, is this really criminal justice happening today? And it is.
We've got Justin from Milwaukee who gave us a call at 800-642-1234, who's got a question for us. Hi, Justin.
Hi. So in Wisconsin, we have a crimeless revocation law, which means anybody who's on probation and parole, if there is an allegation that they have violated the term of their probation or parole, a warrant gets placed for them and they get returned into a prison. I am wondering what your author's opinion or thoughts are on a law like that.
Thanks for the question, Justin. And Jessica, have you looked into the idea of, you know, immediately returning people if bracelet malfunctions or if there's an accusation that they violated parole?
Yeah, so that's not directly sort of a subject in my book, but lots and lots of people throughout this entire country are continually return to jails and prison because of technical violations or because of accusations that have not been proven beyond a reasonable doubt, haven't been necessarily established at all. And it's a huge problem that contributes to our criminal justice population in prisons and jails. So while it may not directly pertain to what I've written about, I do know that it's a huge problem.
All right. Thanks for that question, Justin. We really appreciate it. If you've got a question for our guest, Jessica Henry, you can give us a call at 800-642-1234. Jessica's an associate professor in the Department of Justice Studies at Montclair State University. And here on Central Time, we're talking about wrongful convictions that happen without a crime actually being committed. Jessica, there are actually times when people confess to crimes that didn't happen at all. How does that work? Help us understand what happens there.
Yeah. So, you know, people, whenever I talk about this with my students, they say, I would never confess to a crime that I didn't commit. But of course, there's tremendous pressure placed on individuals to confess, particularly when there's a serious crime that's been alleged. You know, I'm thinking now about there was a 17-year-old woman, Sabrina Butler, over in Mississippi. Again, a child was found dead in his room. My book, by the way, is not only about these horrible cases involving parents with children, but these are just a couple of examples. And she was interrogated for an incredibly long time, and she confessed wrongly, falsely. And she was convicted and she was sent to death row in Mississippi. She was the only woman on death row for a number of years, for about 5 or 6 years, until eventually it was established that she had done nothing wrong. And so think about that for 1 minute. There she was grieving. Her child had just died. And then she was interrogated as though she had harmed him. And there's only, it's not that shocking that at some point you break. And the other thing that happens a lot or frequently is that people plead guilty to crimes they didn't commit. That's also in some ways a wrongful admission in the sense that they're admitting guilt to things that didn't happen. And they do that for a whole host of reasons that have nothing to do with innocence or guilt. It has to do with practical determinations. And here I'm thinking about Tulia, Texas, which is quite famous. Down in Tulia, Texas, there was a law enforcement officer who was brought in to clean up a drug problem that most folks didn't even know Tulia, Texas had. He wound up arresting about 10% of the Black population in Tulia. And the only evidence against them that there was a lot of drugs there was his say-so. There were no lab tests. There was no reports. There was no contemporaneous notes. And after the first few folks went to trial and lost and were sentenced to such long prison terms that your jaw would be on the floor, the rest of the 40-something defendants pled guilty to crimes that never happened. He had manufactured this whole drug problem in the first place. And people plead guilty in part because they're afraid of the consequences if they don't.
Right. It could be worse if you don't plead guilty. Other people haven't won, so you might as well give up and take what's lesser when it comes to punishment,
yes.
Even when you know it's wrong.
Right. You know, you could be facing 25 years if you go to trial, or 50 years, and someone's offering you a plea to probation or 2 years in prison or whatever. You take that plea because the alternative could be so much worse. Mm. And in the Tulia cases, all 48 defendants were ultimately exonerated. There had been no wrongdoing at all. No crimes had ever been committed.
Gil from Milwaukee wants to talk with us. Hi, Gil.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I'm just calling regarding, somebody's charging the innocent person. Our system make them liable? Those are responsible for charging somebody innocent?
Thanks for the question, Gil. We appreciate it. Jessica, does anything happen to people who manufacture these situations or make the wrong decisions and charge when a crime hasn't happened?
Gil, the short answer is no. and I'm not laughing because it's funny. It's just no. Police and prosecutors both have immunity. What your listeners may not know is that prosecutors have absolute immunity for misconduct that they commit in the course of acting as prosecutors. And what that means is they are 100% insulated from being held liable for their wrongdoings. Police are held to a slightly different standard, qualified immunity, but the way that courts have interpreted qualified immunity makes it really hard to hold the police responsible for their wrongdoing. And so most of the time, actors who are involved in these wrongful convictions are not held accountable. Even in cases where it's a civilian who's bringing a false accusation, we rarely see anyone going back and bringing perjury charges against them, even though their lies are what resulted in an innocent person serving time in prison or being convicted of a crime they didn't commit.
So then what happens to people after they've spent time in prison, after being convicted of a crime that didn't happen, and then they were later cleared?
So unfortunately, it depends on what state you're in. There are still numerous states that do not have compensation statutes or who make it really hard for the innocent and exonerated to ever receive compensation at all. And they oftentimes, you know, come back into a world that doesn't necessarily know that they've been exonerated. They just know that they went to prison for a long time and now they're out. And there's a real problem with having innocent people reintegrate into society. It's really challenging for them. They, particularly those who spent many years in prison, there's a huge gap in their life resume. And having to pick up the pieces and start all over is incredibly difficult. And there are not that many programs out there to help the wrongly convicted. You know, someone once said this to me, and it's kind of ironic. If you are convicted of a crime and released, you may be able to receive some level of services through parole and probation. And I don't want to overstate the quality of those programs, but they exist. If you're innocent, you're not eligible because you're not on parole or probation. You've done nothing wrong and you should never have been in prison in the first place. And you certainly aren't under supervision after your release. And so there's
so
this
qualify.
Kind of void.
Yeah,
yeah, there's a void that people who are exonerated live in.
Jessica, you've given us so much to think about. We really appreciate your time today.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. It was a real pleasure.
Jessica Henry was a New York City public defender for nearly 10 years and is now an associate professor in the Department of Justice Studies at Montclair State University. Her new book is called Smoke But No Fire: Convicting the Innocent of Crimes That Never Happened. Coming up, Madison and other cities have seen a rise in shootings this year. We learn about the work community groups are doing to prevent violence before it happens. I'm Keeley Boltina. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina in for Rob Ferret. Coming up Monday morning on the Ideas Network, free clinics care for people who don't have health insurance, and they're seeing new demands during this pandemic. Hear from a leader of charitable clinics and from a medical director. Tune in to the morning show on Monday. It starts at 6 o'clock. Now, 11-year-old Anissa Scott of Madison was shot on Tuesday when someone fired a gun into the car where she was riding. More than 100 people gathered in a Madison park yesterday to remember Anissa and release balloons as she was being taken off life support. At a news conference earlier in the week, family members, including grandmother Cindy Robinson, urged people to put down the guns.
We need to end the violence, the gang violence.
Yes.
We have lost a precious child that we can never get back. It could have been anybody else's child. It happened to be ours.
Anissa Scott's death comes as Madison has seen a sharp rise in violent crime this year. 10 homicides have happened so far, plus 143 shooting incidents. 49 of those happened in July alone, a one-month record since we started keeping track. Madison is not alone. Milwaukee and other cities around the country are reporting more shootings. And while police try to solve cases, the work of preventing retaliation and further violence can fall to community groups. So in a few minutes, we'll talk with someone doing that work. Now we welcome the president of the Madison Common Council. She's Alder Sherry Clark, Council President Carter. I'm sorry, she's Alder Sherry Carter. Council President Carter, thank you for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
we can't find other words to describe it. Anissa Scott's shooting is just heartbreaking. And it comes in this year where we've seen more shootings in Madison than the city's used to. After this latest incident, what are you thinking?
Well, what I'm thinking is that the Black community is going to have to come together and really work at reaching out to these young people. That was part of my press conference on Wednesday, is asking for people to come out and reach out to young people. The death of Anissa is tragic on so many different levels, but it needs to be the catalyst that brings us together and to stop the gun violence.
Police, people who study this, they say they don't have clear answers about the reason that shootings have been up here and around the country. Do you have any idea why this seems to be a more violent year than usual?
Well, my theory is that it is a collection of everything that has happened. It's COVID-19. It's loss of jobs. It's coming to the end of the moratorium
We've ended the evictions moratorium.
Eviction. Thank you so much. Yeah, mm-hmm. The moratorium on eviction. It's all these things, I think, that has come together to create what can call the perfect storm. And I think that we need to, especially with jobs, I mean, not only is there a loss of jobs, there's not that many job companies hiring. So it's even more difficult, right? And so we look at all of that. It's not one thing or another, but I think it's the accumulation of everything that's happening.
In just a few minutes, we're going to talk about community groups working to prevent violence. What do you see the city's role should be in supporting, in implementing, supplementing that kind of work?
Well, I do think that we should supplement it, but I also think that community groups have to look at several resources, if they can, to support their work. It can't just be city government, it can't be county government, and it can't just be state government. It has to be a combination of all of that plus foundations coming together to help these community groups. But the bottom line is, if you know a young person, reach out, talk to them, be their mentor, be their peer. Mm-hmm. They need someone who's on the street that they can identify with.
Yeah, it makes it hard when it's older people or people who haven't lived those circumstances to really gain credibility sometimes. When you say, though, that community groups need to look to different sources, are we talking about the finances to support this kind of work, or are we talking about the establishing leadership and goals and strategy here?
I think we're talking about everything. I agree that it has to be finances, too. But it has to be looking for volunteers that can help your organization on all different levels, so that the ones that are out on the street that can get the grassroots bootstraps can get out there and do that work, while other volunteers might be doing the administrative work. We have to work together on all levels.
And what are your priorities as Common Council President when it comes to stopping violence?
Well, I am looking at working with all community groups, especially the groups of the formerly incarcerated who can tell their story. And they can actually identify with these young adults because they've been there. They were them at one time. So I'm really looking at working with them, but I'm also looking at going forward. I've started a task force on critical issues affecting the Black community, and I'm really looking at bringing together leaders in the Black community and really trying to implement within the Black community, within the churches, within the different community organizations. This is, we're at critical mass, and we all have to work together on this.
Council but President
Carter. We'll start out with the gun violence because that's critical at this time.
Sure. Council President Carter, thank you for sharing your perspective with us today.
Thank you for allowing me to come on your show. Thank you.
We appreciate it. That was Madison Common Council President Sherry Carter talking with us about the rise in shootings this year. And as you have questions about preventing gun violence, you can call us at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the work of interrupting violence? Again, that number is 800-642-1234. Now we turn to Anthony Cooper. He's the executive director of the Focused Interruption Coalition. He's also a nonviolent crisis intervention instructor for the Nehemiah Center for Urban Leadership Development in Madison. Anthony, thanks for being here.
Thank you for having me.
We just talked with Council President Carter about Anissa Scott's killing, and that, as she put it, tragedy has really put it at the front of the news cycle, the concept of gun violence. But for a lot of people, violent crime is not an issue that just popped up this week or this year. It's just a reality where they live. How important is that to remember when we're talking about this?
I mean, it's definitely very, very important. That means that, you know, that's also the separation of what we talk about, what we have in our community. As much as that we talk about, but our focus is in our community, talking about equality and things of that nature. We're definitely is separate. We're in a town of three tails, if we're really being honest. And how do we make sure that we're having that conversation, but then also how are we preventing that from being something that is destroying our youth, but then also destroying our young men and women that who are living it day to day.
We saw signs at events remembering 11-year-old Anissa Scott urging people to put down the guns. What is it going to take to make that happen?
What it's going to really take in order to make that happen is a collaborative from everyone. I was listening when Council President Sherry Carter was speaking. It's not just on the city. It's not just on the county. It takes everyone in our community to be able to work together. I mean this from the homeless person who's living on the street to the CEO of a Fortune 500, because this is affecting all of us.
Yeah, Madison is definitely not alone in seeing a rise in shootings. You know, we heard our earlier guest call it a perfect storm. What's your sense of why we're seeing a particularly violent year when it comes to guns?
I mean, when you look at all the different things that was going on just in our community, we talk about from COVID to people being homeless, to people being able to finding ways of being able to support their families. Being jobless. These are all the things that are, I mean, again, these are things that were happening, but now they're at an all-time high. They're family members that who are in fear of whether or not if they're going to have a place to stay tomorrow, right? When it opens back up, when they can actually be evicted, you know, and it's not the fact that they don't want to pay rent, it's that they don't have the funds in order to keep paying rent. And of course, that's a whole nother bucket of being able to talk to not only landlords, but also being able to navigate situations. Now we have to have a bigger conversation and have we're talking about having a conversation with mortgage companies, right, or lending agencies, because you know, for some people, again, I don't feel it's talked about enough. It is business as usual.
Yeah.
So how do we shift that from these trying times? Because now we also have to be able to talk about the trauma that many of the parents and many of the children are facing right now. You know, because I mean, yes, we have gun violence that is happening at all time high, but also you have to talk about battered situations that are happening inside of the home that are not also being reported, right? So again, this is a community challenge. This is something that we have to all come together and to be able to not only just support, but then also to be able to find different ways of lightening the load.
Yeah, we'll talk more about the fact that gun violence is not isolated, that there's so much context here that we have to try to address. We're talking with the executive director of the Focused Interruption Coalition in Madison. Anthony Cooper stays with us as we consider a rise in shootings this year and what it will take to prevent more in the future. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. How has your family been affected by gun violence? What do you want people to understand? Maybe you've lived in an area where you were concerned about violent crime. How has that shaped your outlook on crime and what it takes to prevent shootings? Call 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Our conversation continues about trying to prevent gun violence here on Central Time. This is the Ideas Network. This is Central Time. I'm Keeley Boltina. We're talking about what goes into community crime prevention in light of a rise in shootings this year in Madison and cities around the country. Our guest is Anthony Cooper, Executive Director of the Focused Interruption Coalition. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What has your experience been with gun violence? How are you thinking about reducing violent crime? What questions do you have for our guest about the on-the-ground work of preventing violence? 800-642-1234 is the number, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. Anthony, tell us more about the Focused Interruption Coalition. What is the purpose of the work?
The purpose of the work is basically, to be able to help situations and help navigate families when they are in these crisis filled situations, and even if it's at the scene of a crime, and family members are trying to find out if that's a loved one that who has been struck by gunfire. Or if it's at the hospital, being able to help them navigate the situation, help them navigate talking with hospital staff, help them navigate with law enforcement calls, or when there is even times when there are, you may have anywhere from 75 to 100 family members that may happen to show up at the hospital to make sure it doesn't become a hostile situation. To be able to help in that process, to be able to become that, to be that trusted messenger in that moment. We respond 24/7. This is something that we, not only just responding at the scene, but also we responded and talking to families and also being able to talk to loved ones when they don't know how to deal or when they're having challenges in the community.
There's been a lot to talk about this year about policing and law enforcement. We've been talking about the relationship between law enforcement and Black people. What kind of policing do you see that's needed to build trust in the long run with more people to hopefully curtail some of this violence?
I mean, one of the things that I think what I must say is the fact that, the relationship between Black and brown people and with the law enforcement, it's not something that we can just, snap our fingers and say, hey, this is fixed. This is where we have this, this magic tool, and now everything is going to be all right. It's going to take time, just like it took time for us to get to this moment, right? It has took time for us to even be able to have the discussion. One of the bigger challenges is also that that there's real action that is happening behind it, to be able to really, to really be able to have to come to the table with an open heart, but then also with an open mind and challenge the ideas of both people in the community, but also law enforcement and how policing is done as well. There's not, there are some great officers out there. There are some people, there are great Black people out there, great white people out there. There's people that who really want to be able to see a new way, a new age of doing things, right? But then there are people who do dumb stuff, right? Who do things that shouldn't and should actually, you should go to jail for that crime. Right. But I think the bigger issue is when things are not done just with justice. Right. Things are not done fairly
things are not done on the same level all the way around the board. When those things are not done, then we have other challenges. When people are not being held accountable, when those things don't happen, then of course we're going to continue to have problems. It is because if I'm out here, and that matter of fact, now I think about it, I don't even think it's on the police officers on their badge anymore. Protect and serve. Right. So, so what does that really mean? What is that really? Is it who are you protecting? So, you know, again, it's us being able to have an open and bold conversation. But not only just a conversation, but to be able to make sure that there's action that has to happen behind it. That means I'm talking about from hiring practices. We need to revamp all the way around.
Yeah, we're talking with Anthony Cooper, who's the executive director of the Focused Interruption Coalition, also a nonviolent crisis intervention instructor. And we're talking about interrupting that cycle of violence and preventing gun violence. And as we talk about our communities of color, you know, we heard our earlier guest say, reach out to young people in the Black community. Is that where our attention should be? Or is that a sort of victim blaming? I mean, how do we even try to approach this?
But the thing is, we have to reach out to everyone. I would say this publicly. I love Sherry. She definitely has a lot of phenomenal points of what she hit it on the head. But also, we cannot forget about the mothers. We cannot forget about the fathers because there's a lot of damage that's already been done.
Right. Well,
I'm sorry, but, you know, so we have to make sure it's not victim blaming. It's a thing of there's some that needs to be fixed. Excuse my language, but it's not going to just happen overnight. But what I am going to say is, are we willing as a community to put in the work to make sure things change?
Yeah, I think that's what's so striking about this challenge is that there's obviously no one answer to how we're going mm-hmm. to solve for gun violence, because there are so many different factors that play into it. And even as you were talking about the different things people are up against with, challenges with work stability or housing instability, or just the stresses that are now placed on these already, frustrating circumstances, it's overwhelming to think about, and it's hard to know where to start so that you're doing good.
Mm-hmm. Right, exactly. I think even though I think I 100% agree with you, but we have to start somewhere. And it can't just be just focused, because if we only focus on the kids, then we have children that are still going back home to jacked up families, right? So, or families who are still struggling. So we have to, the focus has to be on the whole family. The focus has to be on the whole community.
Right. It's not just the kids or the adults or these certain people. It's about everybody, because it affects everybody.
Right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And we have to make sure that that's happening now, because what's going to happen, there's still going to be some shots fired. There's still going to be some challenges with trust. There's still going to be some other issues that are happening in our community that we can fix together, but it's going to be hard for us to fix it apart because the separation has already been there. The separation has been there for generations.
Anthony, right. We really appreciate your perspective on this, and we thank you for taking the time to talk with us about it.
Yeah, not a problem.
Anthony Cooper is the executive director of the Focused Interruption Coalition. And earlier we talked with Madison Common Council President Sherry Carter. They were with us to talk about community crime prevention in Madison, which, like many cities around the country, is seeing a spike in shootings and homicides this year. And coming up on Central Time on Monday, we're talking about corruption in America. Our guest says the United States shows signs similar to other countries known for unethical practices. We'll also talk about U.S. officials sending migrant kids back to their home countries because the feds say children pose a risk of spreading COVID-19. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Monday on the State Capitol Report, we're talking with Secretary Mary Kohler. She's the Secretary of the Wisconsin Department of Veterans Affairs. Learn how the state is working to support veterans and ask your questions on Monday morning during the State Capitol Report. That starts at 7 o'clock. Coming up next, it's news from NPR and WPR. And then for Food Friday, we are talking tomatoes. We'll find out how to use them fresh, cook with them, even preserve them to enjoy during the long, dark Wisconsin winter. Yes, it is ahead of us. And we'll get recipes for classic caprese salad, cheesy tomato onion tart, and Wisconsin fried green tomatoes. I'm Keeley Boltina. This is the Ideas Network, and you're listening to Central Time.